see what goes on.
Okay.
It's a... Where do you want to start?
Start wherever you want to start. Have you got some questions to ask?
You've been in Baltimore since 1908.
That's right.
You were here shortly after the Baltimore fire. You lived in the First World War here. You've seen a depression here. What has changed in Baltimore?
My, that's a hard one. I suppose that one of my problems is that that my memory of my youth is probably less accurate than it ought to be. Well, it is. It's not so much an inaccuracy as it is that I don't remember much about my youth, and that's not just a product of my present age, but I think I never have remembered much about it. There are things that I know about even in my school days. And all my schooling was at one school, at Park School, that I remember very, very little of, and I think that my wife insists that one of the reasons is because I was, because I must have had a happy childhood, and I think perhaps I did. I think it was easier to have happy childhoods in those days. There was much less turmoil and strife, much less polarization in the community. Interestingly enough, I grew up on Bolton Street, although I didn't go to school. I didn't go to a neighborhood school. I went to Park School, which meant going on public transportation. That was practically from the time I started, being taken at first and then going on my own public transportation. And I lived in a neighborhood in which none of my neighbors went to Park School, happened not to. Most of them went either to public school or to friend school. In those days, friend school still had a... In those days, to start, in those days, as many people as could, made, I think, more sacrifices then to send children to non-public school, partly because the schools in those days, when I started school, were in turmoil because of feeling that the school system was inadequate and badly run. Those were the days of the schools were full of politics. It's not comparable to the day situation about public schools. There's a whole different attitude about it. There it was a political thing and the schools being badly run. And my parents, at that time I know, made substantial sacrifices to send my sister and me both to school. This, of course, is hearsay. This is not something of my own knowledge. I didn't know why I went to Park School. It just seemed the thing to do. And I think one of the reasons is an interesting thing, and that is that of the non-private schools, I lived a block and a half from Friends School because I grew up on 1600 block of Bolton Street. And Friends School was in those days at Park Avenue and Robert Street. Robert, Park Avenue, yeah. Park Avenue and Lawrence Street, not Robert, Park Avenue and Lawrence Street. And the Friends School, I'm sure it'd be hard for the Quakers to believe today, the Friends School had a quota, it only had admitted very few Jews. And actually that's what led to the start of Park School. Park School started in 1912, and I started going to kindergarten there, I guess in 1913. So the Park School had been started by a group of people, many of them Jewish, because of the fact that that there wasn't a school in Baltimore, a private school in Baltimore, that admitted Jewish students on a on anything but a quota basis. Some of them, I suppose, were actually close to them. I really don't know. But Friends School had a quota of some sort. I know that because my sister went there for 1 year, but I'm for only 1 year, and then when Park School started, she transferred there. That's how Park School started as a school, and even to this day, 60 years later, is known primarily as a school where a large number of Jewish kids go. But it hasn't tried to keep that reputation in recent years, but that's the way it started. But my point is that I grew up in a neighborhood, a neighborhood that, in a sense, was less segregated than a lot of our neighborhoods today. I don't mean segregated in terms of black and white, because of course I grew up in a society in Baltimore that was in many ways shockingly segregated. And nothing really happened of any great consequence in Baltimore until the school desegregation decisions in 1954. But segregation as far as religion is concerned in living, regardless of what caused it, whether it's as much a product of Jewish style and Jewish mores, I don't know why. Well, some of it came back because of restrictions in those days, even in restrictions in deeds in a great many residential areas, particularly in better residential areas like Roland Park. But at Dalton Street where I lived, I grew up there in a neighborhood that had really all kinds of people in it. It's an interesting thing. I think that's been a great benefit to me in my life. And not so many people who didn't grow up in the inner city had that kind of opportunity. But we had all kinds of people in my very block on Dalton Street. The Attorney General of the state lived there. A concert master of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra lived across the street from us.
Do you remember the names?
The concert master of the Baltimore Symphony was named Van Holstein. Van Hulstein, I think. John C. Van Holstein. I didn't know that because I took violin lessons from him for a while. This was an aborted business for him and for me, but I didn't like teaching the violin. He didn't like teaching it to me. I remember his only comment on my violin playing was, "Ooh, it scratches." But my parents thought I ought to learn how to play an instrument, but they soon learned that this wasn't a useful thing. But Alexander Armstrong lived down the street. Dr. Amos Kuntz, who got to be not only a famous surgeon in Baltimore, but a famous ultra conservative physician politically. He and Mrs. Kuntz lived next door to us for many, many years. I remember the Slimlots who lived across the street, the Watsons who lived up the street from us. The Doyles who lived next door to us. This was a very pleasant neighborhood, a very nice neighborhood, and people got along extraordinarily well. And although I went to a school that kept you late in the day because they had athletics, so that I didn't know the kids in the neighborhood as well as I would have liked to. And I think those were brought on both sides about this because they were nice kids, and I just didn't get to know them well. I got to know them best when it snowed, and we snowed, but we used to sled down the two hills of Bolton Street from Lawrence down to McMecken Street. And there were streetcars on McMecken Street in those days. I remember that in those days there were also plenty of ashes in all of our houses. Is this the kind of reminiscence you want?
This is meaningless.
This is anybody's reminiscence of Baltimore back in those in the Thames, I guess.
Park School was founded by Randolph Smith. It had a reputation.
Eugene Randolph Smith. How do you know about Eugene Randolph Smith?
A little research.
Not really?
Yeah.
But the school had a reputation.
Is it really?
Yeah.
But the school had a reputation for being permissive. Did you feel it was permissive at the time?
Oh, no. I think that progressive education got this reputation in later years. When I first went there, I don't think, certainly not by today's standards, would have been regarded as permissive. And I remember it more as being experimental than being permissive. I know that all of us got so used to being tested. All kinds of standardized tests. This stood me in good stead when I got to college, because when I got to college, we'd only been there a couple days. The Carnegie Foundation was running a series of tests of college freshmen, and then you took a test, I think, again senior year. They were doing some kind of a nationwide testing thing, and Haverford College was involved in it. And I remember that I went into Robert's Hall at Haverford, all my classmates very shortly after we got there. And we took this test to standardize, it was some kind of a test. It was a test, obviously, that I had never seen before, but it was of a type that I had seen. I was familiar with it, the types of, you know, different types of things. Some of them were geometric comparisons of geometric, you know, figures. Some of them are sentence completion tests, tests to test your vocabulary and things of the sort. Algebraic tests, things of this sort. And it was the first time I had been in a testing situation where everybody else wasn't on the same level that I was of being accustomed to testing. Back in those days, kids weren't as accustomed to tests, I suppose, as they are now. And so I could plunge right into this test. While I was hearing groans all around me of people who didn't understand the instructions or thought they didn't and were hesitant or embarrassed by it, it was all that to me. And I think not very wisely, Haverford posted the scores that people have gotten. Well, I was kind of disgraced by being up in the first half dozen or the first 10 or something. I don't remember where I was. This wasn't the kind of thing that you wanted to do. You didn't want to be known as a brain among your peers in college. So what I set out to prove that this was based on familiarity. And I remember I took the first 10 names and I interviewed these classmates of mine and discovered that my memory, this isn't exact, but I think it was something like 8 out of 10 had this kind of testing. They had also gone to some kind of a school or experimental school or progressive school or whatever it was called. And this was my first scientific acquaintanceship with tests, something I fooled around with a lot in later time in business and everything else. But it destroyed my faith in them. The familiarity with tests is a big help, I really think. You're studying psychology, aren't you? I really believe this is true. You start off, because these things are limited in time, and part of the score is not only on your accuracy, but how many of them you complete. And I proved, you know, by a great series, without a shadow of a doubt, that my good score on this was the result of my familiarity with it rather than my lack of familiarity. But my recollections of Park School are a good bit of that type of experimental thing. And I remember that your friends and the people who knew you thought, you know, there must be a little something funny about you if you went to Park School. And for a while, people thought there was something wrong with you if you went there. They took the goblin gift. I don't remember it as being terribly permissive. Although, I guess I didn't have enough to compare it with. I really wouldn't know. I remember small escapades of things that happened and of you're catching a good bit of hell for yelling out in class or something of the sort. But I suspect that was the exuberance of youth and that there was the exuberance wasn't particularly limited to a single school.
Do you remember any of the names of the people that you went to school with then? Have they come into the limelight recently?
Oh, I remember people who were, you know, in my class. Samuel Hecht was in my class. I can remember the names of a number of people. I'm trying to think of people who have come into the limelight recently. I can't think of that particularly in terms of limelight, although I'm sure there many of them have. It was a small class. I think my class probably had 20 people in it then. It was quite a small school.
When you said you jumped on the public transportation, I'm sure you didn't mean the bus.
That was a streetcar. I took a streetcar on Linden Avenue. I no longer remember the number. When I first went to school, this was before, I suppose, I'm trying to think how I got to school in those days. The school was then on what was known as Alcantarelli Terrace, which is really part of the drive through Druid Hill Park now. It was in a house that perhaps still stands there, although I think not. This was where the school started, on Alcantarelli Terrace near Mount Bellman Avenue, near what is now Vince Falls Parkway. And I went in a portable school that they had built there, where I remember you used to have to wear, my memory's better than I thought it was for some things, where you had to wear kind of a sleeping bag because the place was too cold. I went there until I think the fourth grade, and I think when I was in the fourth grade, the school moved to Liberty Heights Avenue, which is where the Bowman Community College is now. actually, Community College bought the site from Park School, and Park School moved out to the road that it's on now, near the Beltway.
As a trustee of Park School, were you involved with any of that sale or transaction?
As a trustee of Park School, no. I was a board member at the time, but I wasn't particularly involved in the transactions, I remember. Actually, I remember at the time I kept out of the transaction because it occurred at a time when I had some kind of a city connection. It occurred either when I was on the school board or when I was with the Urban Renewal Commission. I forgot what year it occurred. But whenever it did, I remember keeping out of it. I had to keep out of it because they were dealing with the city and I didn't want to have any conflict or anything.
To get back, the transportation, was it horse-drawn, or was it electrified, or was it motorized, do you recall?
No, I'm not that old. It wasn't horse-drawn, it was electrified. It was those streetcars, very much like some of the older ones, I suppose. Not the oldest ones, but some of the older ones that are in the streetcar museum up on below North Avenue Bridge. But I remember the streetcars pretty well. Those, of course, were before the days when they had only motormen. They had motormen and conductors. And actually, it was a very pleasant thing morning and evening because in those days, as I remember, you had the same conductor and motorman pretty much most of the time. You got to know people and you got to know the people who were riding on. But it was a pleasanter and easier life. Although I have to say that I think, if you look back on the part of your life that was pleasanter and easier, in terms of the way kids have to ride on buses today and with the dangers inherent in it and the rumpuses that are raised on the buses and things, I think although I didn't come from what would be known as a wealthy family in any sense of the word, my family was comfortable enough to afford sending me to school and things of that sort. They spent less money on some of the more elaborate things like housing and some other people did, although we had a nice house on Bolton Street. But you begin to realize that this was a small percentage of people who had this kind of a life, and that you really were having a shelter and a pleasant, reasonably trouble-free life, I think, at the expense of people who didn't have it as well.
The second interview is being conducted at Mr. Sondheim's office at 9 o'clock, Thursday, December the 16th.
In a file, because my memory's not that good.
Okay, what examples of de jure and de facto segregation do you recall from your work on the school board?
Well, of course, when I went on the school board, and up until 1954, Baltimore operated under a... Baltimore operated under a school system that was segregated, but had separate schools in those terms for colored and for white by law. And so, except for an exception I'll mention in a minute, there was no de facto segregation. I mean, there was no de facto integration until the Supreme Court decision. I think it's fair to say that the school board's point of view could best be described in general as liberal over that period of time, so that any opportunity to encourage or to lessen the impact of a segregated system was something that was welcomed by the board. For some time, and I really don't know when it started, I think perhaps before I came on the board in 48, but I'm not really sure, the system
there were integrated teachers' meetings. It seems strange in today's world to think that this was anything very earth-shaking. But as recently as post-World War II, this was considered a major step forward. I think previous to that, the teachers who we had, there were, of course, colored teachers in colored schools, to use the vernacular of the time, and white teachers in white schools, and they met separately, they had separate organizations, and it was only after World War II, and I can't tell, I don't know exactly when it happened. I think perhaps before I came on the school board, but it's possible that it was afterward, that the superintendent, on his own initiative, merged the meetings of teachers, and in general, like, and other teachers. We had the situation of teachers meeting together, and of I think a spirit of trying to run the schools on an equal basis as possible. But as far as the segregation was concerned, there really was none until the year 19. There were two assaults made on the segregation of schools. And the most important one was a case involving Poly students. Poly had then, as it has now, an A course and a B course. The A course, I think, perhaps was the most prestigious thing in the city school system, and perhaps better known, and although I'm not in a position to evaluate really today, I think more prestigious than it was today, than it is today. This was a course in which students, boys, went through a specially structured course that enabled them to go after graduation into the sophomore class of the top engineering schools in the country. This course had gone on for many years, and the Urban League decided to make a test case of the segregation of the schools based on the exclusion of colored boys from the A course at Poly. And they were excluded, of course, because Poly was part, was the white part of the segregated school system. The superintendent, make it clear that it was not because he was sympathetic to a segregated school system, because indeed he wasn't, but because it was the law, organized a course at Douglas High School, which was to be comparable to the Poly A course, and set this up and offered it as a substitute for the Poly course. A suit was brought on behalf of, five or ten young colored boys who were qualified without question. They had been very carefully selected, qualified without question for admission to the Poly A course, and they applied for the Poly A course and were turned down and told that a course would be available to them at Douglas High School. They then asked for a hearing before the school board on the basis of the fact that that no course that was set up at Douglas would have the tradition behind it, the excellence behind it, and that in general it was impossible to set up a course really comparable to the A course at Poly, to set one up overnight. The school board had a tense and dramatic hearing about this, and it was really one of the remarkable experiences of my life. Judge Rosalind Thompson, retired chief judge of the federal district court in Maryland, was president of the school board at the time, and he handled the whole situation, both the steps leading up to it and the hearing itself, in truly exemplary manner. I think he was tremendously admired for it.
Do you recall the individuals or groups who were for and against?
Yes, I have some recollection of it. Actually, I still have a stenographic transcript of that hearing. The groups for it, the Urban League handled a case. The NAACP, which in those days was looked on as a fairly radical group to a lot of white people, asked to present a case, and after consultation with the Urban League, the Urban League and the NAACP were more competitive in those days than they are today, much more competitive, and the Urban League asked that they be wanted to handle the case alone. I think they sensed that they might have a victory and they wanted the victory to be theirs. The NAACP protested this, but the way the hearing was set up, the NAACP, the Urban League was allowed to put on the case, and after the case was put on, there was to be an opportunity for anyone else to speak who wanted to speak. And so the NAACP was relegated to speaking at the end of the thing, just as part of the audience. And it's interesting to note that the chief speaker for the NAACP at that time was a man named Thurgood Marshall, who was brought down from New York. And I remember his presentation very well. Opposition, let me say that I have to qualify the word opposition. What the superintendent did was to defend the premise that he could set up an equivalent course, so that the administration of the school, in effect, was in opposition, but not truly in opposition to it, although they put on saying that they could duplicate this course. There were some questions raised by the Alumni Association of Poly, who was an extremely active alumni association, that can't quite be qualified as opposition. There was a complete absence of bitterness, vindictiveness in the whole hearing, but I would say that in general that they put up a case that raised questions that put them in the position of being opposed to it, although I think it revealed that of the testimony might indicate that might not quite classify them as opponents.
Okay.
Interestingly enough, the case was going so well, when you ask about opposition, and I now remember that Thurgood Marshall put on such an impassioned plea and became highly emotional about the case, although the case had been the Judge Thompson had kept the case, the presentation of the case, on a very low key, so that it was a factual, and although I think the very low key made the presentation very dramatic. And the presentation on behalf of the Urban League, incidentally, was handled by Marshall Lynn, who was then a young lawyer in Baltimore and has recently been made a judge in the Supreme Bench of Baltimore City, just recently. Thurgood Marshall got quite emotional about the case and suggested the school board was afraid, which indeed it wasn't. And interestingly enough, in retrospect, in fact, I remember thinking at the time, most of us thought at the time, that he almost killed the case by becoming over emotional and by, in effect, accusing the school board of more bias than it really possessed in its own heart. What happened was that the school board then voted on the admission of the students to Poly, and in an extremely dramatic vote, which was quite close, the man on the school board who cared most about this in terms of, who had as strong a feeling as any person on the school board, I should say, perhaps not cared most, was Professor Truman Thompson at Johns Hopkins University, who was a member of the school board and an engineer, and who I know personally and who stated at the time that he was vigorously opposed to a segregated school system and felt we should not have one, still found himself in his own judgment to found in his own judgment that that an equivalent course could be set up, and therefore voted against the admission of these young men. This was interesting because it was perhaps the most legal vote on the school board at the time, because he did it out of what he felt was his own knowledge. Those of us who voted to admit the boys, I am sure, were motivated somewhat by the fact that this was an opportunity to breach the wall of segregation, as it were, and provide an opportunity within the law to move the school system forward to some extent. Because actually, although we were prohibited by city ordinance and by state law from running any part of the school system on a segregated basis, there have been recent Supreme Court decisions that said the facilities had to be, if they were separate, had to be equal. And that, of course, is a thing which the Powell case hinged. Right now, the Powell boys were admitted, and several of them went to Powell the next year, and nothing happened. These two things are important because I think they paved the way for the segregation of the school system. Now, I suppose what you'd like to hear is something about 1954. Well, in early May of 1954, Judge Thompson was appointed by the president. It had been somewhat earlier that he'd been appointed by the president and was confirmed by the Senate in early May of 54 to be a judge of the United States Court for the District of Maryland. And he was sworn in fairly early in May of 1954. And in about the middle of the year, I was, the middle of the month, I was appointed by the mayor. Actually, by the mayor and acting mayor. The mayor was sick, and but that's an unimportant part of history. To be president of the school board and was confirmed by the city council. I was sworn in on. I think on May 26th, although my appointment had been announced on May 13th, the time in between was taken up with confirmation of the city council. I've forgotten the exact date of the Supreme Court decision, but I think it was pretty near. It was, I think, on the 17th, on the Monday following my appointment and the week before my swearing in. So that I got a good bet right at the start of action on the school board. The story of the school board's action at that time has been told so often that it really has been documented elsewhere. Eleanor Pankhurst, a study of it. There have been a number of articles written about it.
Do you feel these articles have been accurate?
They were highly accurate. The study that Eleanor Pankhurst did is for the Ford Foundation a year later, which chronicled both the events that led up to the desegregation of schools and the what seemed then to be great trouble that we had in the schools, but in retrospect was very modest trouble, were very accurate and really much more accurate than my memory would be about the things that happened. I think all of us on the school board were interviewed to death for a year after that about what had happened. But in brief, what happened was the school board met. There was a lot of telephone discussion, I must say, among us we had a history in those days of trying as hard as we could to have a minimum of controversy on the school board. We felt that it was important that the system be run on the basis where, well, let me say that I think there was understanding that a public school system at best is going to be a subject of a good bit of controversy in the city, and that the school board itself serves the city best if it doesn't become a center of controversy. I happen to believe, still believe this is true, that this is the way the kids get served best. And that is a criticism I have of the way the school board operates at present, with so little restraint on its own, on controversy within its own body. But there was a great deal of discussion of points of view over the telephone. We met once and asked the city solicitor for an opinion as to the effect of the Supreme Court decision in Brown versus Board of Education on the city's ordinance requiring separate schools for colored and white. And I want to point out, I'm using the vernacular of the time when I talk about colored and white. We had a brief note from the city solicitor, Thomas Bivison, who said that the Supreme Court's decision made the city ordinance unconstitutional and invalid, and the school board was in effect free to do, was not bound by the city ordinance. It's interesting that I think that there was practically no hesitation on the part of the school board of deciding to desegregate the schools and to do it immediately. We talked about it some. I think that there was a genuine feeling that, one, that we had a school system, had a city that was somewhat prepared for it. Two, that the law was the law and not a subject for debate after the law was passed. I think we knew that there would be opposition, and I remember one discussion that some of us had and said that the way to avoid the opposition, to avoid the opposition or to meet the opposition, was to do what had to be done legally and not give credence to the theory that this was something that people had an opportunity to vote and discuss. I have to say that in retrospect, that I think this was a very wise thing for us to have done, because debate could have gone on forever. Subsequent events have shown in other parts of the country, and that those people who sincerely in their hearts believe that this was an unwise thing, that a segregated school system was bad for the country, have really over the years been given a false hope of thinking that discussion had something to do with it when the Supreme Court has spoken. And I think the way to have respect for the law personally is to observe the law, and I don't mean that just for myself. I think this was true of other people on our school board. And I have to say that that I do believe that our school board was somewhat relieved by the Supreme Court decision in terms of the fact that none of us in our hearts really believe that the best education could be obtained in the long run in a segregated school system. So we met in a meeting that, to say that the meeting wasn't prepared in advance is not to tell the truth. To say that it was spontaneous is wrong. We decided what we were going to do. John Sherwood had prepared a brief resolution in his own handwriting, and we opened the meeting as a standard school board meeting, and asked for review. I think that we read the city solicitor's letter, and John Sherwood presented a resolution which in fact said that the schools would be open the following September on a desegregated basis, and ask the superintendent to bring as rapidly as possible to the school board his plans for desegregating schools next September. It was passed unanimously, and all of this could not have taken more than a minute and a half, and we went on to the routine business that was prepared for the agenda of transfers, appointments, and all the other things of school board meeting. I'll never forget the reporter for the Afro-American, and it's interesting, I'm pretty sure, almost certain, that it was Mrs. Betty Moss, I mean, her name then was Mrs. Betty Phillips. Now, Mrs. Moss, who is now a member of the school board, was a reporter for the Afro-American at the time, and she came rushing in. And I have to say I'm sorry for Betty Moss. She missed the service. She missed the historic event because she arrived at the school board meeting after it was all over. And I remember that this occurrence. What has happened, I don't think any of us had the sense of, you don't have a sense of history when history's happening, I suppose. It was a very exciting thing, and there was good outpouring of pride on the part of Baltimoreans that Baltimore was the first city to do this. I think Baltimore was the first large city certainly, to respond in this affirmative way to the Supreme Court decision. District of Columbia came just afterwards. And John Fisher, the superintendent of schools, who played a tremendous role in this whole thing, came back a week or 2 weeks later, I don't remember the exact chronology, with a plan for opening schools on a segregated basis, and indeed we did open on a segregated basis in September. And we had some trouble, with all of which has also been well documented by a number of people. Awful lot of studies made. Gertrude Samuels, I remember the New York Times came down and did an article on it. We were all kind of celebrities for a year on the school board and in the school system. Because one, with the speed with which we had desegregated schools, and two, because of the trouble we had in September, and I think the thing for which we got to be pretty well known was the fact that the trouble got put down and ended as quickly as it did. It started, as has been documented, in a elementary school on Washington Boulevard, where some people some mothers were upset about this and began picketing the school and keeping their children home. And then this spread to Southern High and to Murdoch and to some other places, with kids having a kind of a holiday parade through the streets. It really wasn't rough. It was there was some name calling, and there was some confrontation on the steps of the courthouse near the Battle Monument. I think that was one of the turning points, because I was standing near Commissioner Ober, who was Commissioner of Police at the time, and a rotten tomato just missed Commissioner Ober's ear, and this upset him. Commissioner Edward said to me, I can't remember all of the meetings we had with police. I remember having private telephone numbers of people to call. If I got in trouble, they were a little worried. And I was subjecting, I suppose, most of the school board members, but because I happened to be president of the school board, got a fair amount of abuse, and the police were concerned about picketing my business, that trouble at home and things of this sort, and I carry around telephone numbers, private telephone numbers, and I never had to use them. I never had any of that trouble. I got some abusive telephone calls, of course. I got some abusive mails, some of it anti-Semitic, most of it just anti-black. Suggestions about possible candidates in marriage for my daughter and things of this sort. Somebody called me a Judas goat. I had never heard what a Judas goat was, and I had to look that one up. But that really was not, it really wasn't as bad or as dramatic as I thought it was at the time, I guess. the trouble in the Colonel Over, the Commissioner of Police, was really a hero in this. A hero because he did what he felt was right, even though he had a question about the school board did. He said to me once, when he thought, in the middle of this, he said, "You know, Mr. Sonheim, I want you to know that I almost remember his words. He said, "I'm not sure I think that you did a wise thing, that you didn't move too hastily, that you should have prepared Baltimoreans better for a desegregated school system." But he said, "That's not my job." He said, "That's the job of all of you to run the schools. My job's to run the police department." He said, "I'm not going to stand for violence in Baltimore. My job's to keep law and order." And he said, "Nobody in the police department's going to take sides in this issue about whether you made a wise decision or not." Well, you've got to respect a man who said this. And it's Commissioner Roper that in the last analysis stopped the trouble we had in schools. This thing spread to a lot of schools. Some of the memories of it start coming back to me. Ed, is this what you want to hear? I remember, you remember a lot of isolated instances. I remember meetings with police officials to discuss what we were going to do. Some of them wanted us to close the schools, and a number of us felt, and I know I felt very strongly, that the absolutely worst, that this is what segregationists, which is what people were, wanted us to do, which was to close the schools. And John Fisher and I sat down one day and decided that that was absolutely the worst thing to do. We prepared a statement, so I remembered saying, if the schools were open, we were going to stay open. The worst thing to do was to close them, even if there were no kids in the school. And of course, some of the schools, for those few days, attendance went down very severely. One of the things that broke the back of it, interestingly enough, that in today's world, I suppose, it would not be as successful. One of the most important things was the discovery by a couple people who had worked on this. Forgotten who all of them were. One of them was Leon Sachs, who dug up a law which said that it was illegal to interfere with the operation of the school system. This was an old law in the books of Maryland. Actually, this is the thing that stopped it finally, because they told Commissioner Over about this, and Commissioner Over took this law and went on television one evening, and I've forgotten which evening in the week it was. My memory of the sequence of days would have to be refreshed, but as I say, it's all been chronicled. Went on television and said that such a law was on the books, and his job was to enforce the law, and starting at 9 o'clock the next morning, he was going to enforce the law. This is what really broke it. His policeman went out to school on Washington Boulevard, for example. I wasn't there at the time, but someone who was there from the school system, I forgot where I was probably down at Southern High School or someplace, said at 9 o'clock, said to the mothers who were picketing the school, "Okay, ladies, this is it. It's 9 o'clock and the school bells rung, and that's it." And the picket line folded up and went away and didn't come back. And it was just, it was that simply dramatic that this thing happened. I do remember, though, we were sitting in John Fisher's office the morning before this, because it was at that time we were there to get this report on that law, as I remember. And we were sitting in John Fisher's office. Now, before I say the next thing, I have to go back and say that one of the things that was one of the best things about that whole situation was the calm and restraint shown by the black community. We talked to a number of the leaders and put it on the basis that this was a white man's problem. And that if they kept a very low profile this time, that this would be the best thing. And I just can't, I now remember the admiration I had for the restraint that was shown in the worst kind of provocation. because the name calling that went on, the things that were said were enough to provoke anybody, and this thing, I think because they felt that the city administration, particularly the schools, were doing their part in it, were doing what they could to straighten the matter out, that they exercised restraint. But now, to get back this time to John Fisher's office, we were sitting in John Fisher's office talking about the law thing, and into the room barged Clarence Mitchell. Clarence Mitchell, who then as now, was a top official for the NAACP in Washington. He's a Baltimorean, his wife is Bonita Jackson Mitchell. And their son had been entered in the junior high school on Hilton Street, south of Edmondson Avenue, which had not only been a white school up until that September, but was still an overwhelmingly white school, was in a extremely conservative area and an area that was very much opposed to desegregation of schools, and had a principal who at the time was not very sympathetic, I might say, to desegregation. And the picket line had been established there, and Clarence Mitchell was outraged and said that he just wanted us to know he was going to establish a counter picket line. Well, this was just about all we needed. And I talked to Mr. Mitchell, and some other people talked to him, and he was so upset at what was happening to the school where his son was going, and that there were pickets outside. And I might say there was some pretty vicious picketing outside that school with some automobiles. I don't know why we have the license numbers of some cars. I can't remember exactly what had happened. I do remember that there was, the police were particularly concerned about it. Someone called the Afro-American then and talked to, I suppose, to Mr. Carl Murphy, who was then the publisher of the Afro-American. And if you were to pick a single leader in the Negro community, it was Carl Murphy, Mr. Carl Murphy. And the counter-picketing didn't occur. I'm a little hazy on exactly why not, but I think it was a combination of our trying to convince Mr. Mitchell that he shouldn't do this. I think perhaps Mr. Murphy getting hold of Mr. Mitchell and talking about it. This was, I suppose, just the day before the trouble ended. There were a lot of other things that happened in that period of time. Some of them personal. Brian Bowles, who became famous in Delaware, he was a National Association for the Advancement of White People, or National States Rights Party or something. There's a man who's still active in Baltimore, from whom I have some choice correspondence in the file, who had two sons in Southern High School, and who led the National Association for the Advancement of White People, and something else, National States Rights Party. He's run for office a couple times in Maryland. A man named Luthart, who is still in Baltimore. You ever heard of him? Charles Luthart. He had some uncomplimentary things to say about me, and I suppose still does. I'm not sure he didn't sue me. He got sued pretty regularly at the school board in those days, and I think maybe he sued me for something. Well, I know I said something on a television program. Somebody put on a television program about this a year later. It showed, had some film clips of Mr. Newhart being hustled into a police car, perhaps, or something of the sort. I really don't know exactly what it was, and he got sued on that. But there are a flood of memories of what happened in those days, of Brian Bowles speaking down in Anne Arundel County because he couldn't get a permit in Baltimore City. Highly inflammatory person. I think he ended up in jail in Texas someplace for killing someone, I'm not sure. But in retrospect, our troubles lasted only a few days. The kids were magnificent. Kids at Southern High School were great. Captain of the football team, the president of the class, walked out of Southern High School. I remember seeing them actually acting as a kind of a bodyguard and escort for colored kids in the school. Magnificent example. The thing brought about really an era of good feeling in Baltimore. It's hard to believe, and a great shame that's been lost. It's tough to talk about those days, which have a certain kind of glory about them in view of the problems that we have in our cities today.
Do you feel that the various medias gave you fair coverage in that? Television, newspaper, radio?
Well, I suppose I'd have to say yes, although there were vigorous attempts on that part to minimize the inflammatory headlines. And I don't know anybody in public life, and any of the things I've done since, anybody I know in public life or anything else who was ever satisfied with the headlines in the newspaper. And I remember Aaron getting very upset at the time about, and I don't remember whether it was the Sun or the News American, about the inflammatory nature of the headlines, because as usual, and I suppose this is part of the trade, although I can't always agree with it, the newspapers picked the most dramatic things that were happening and made them into the stories, and some of the less dramatic things that we thought were perhaps more important didn't get the prominence. We met with the newspapers regularly during this period of time. We met with the newspapers before the schools were desegregated. There was one editorial writer, on the Baltimore Sun, who raised a lot of questions about our moving too quickly, but his colleagues all said that he was wrong. I think he turned out to be wrong. I don't think Baltimore would have been worse off if we had delayed what we did. And it worked very well for a while. The trouble that the schools have any place, I'm not just talking about Baltimore, can't be traced to what happened in 1954. They're a reflection of a spirit, of a demand on the part of people that there be nothing but first-class citizenship in America. And the turmoil that follows because of that is an enormous turmoil. What more do you want to know? I could talk for, I'm just talking again about something I was talking about. You remember something so vividly. I just remember where I was sitting in John Fisher's office the day Clarence Mitchell walked in there, sweat pouring down his face. So upset, and understandably upset. This was his kid who was having something happen to him. And insistent that this wasn't going to happen. And I remember just where I was sitting on the couch when this happened. It was a dramatic moment, and you remember certain things like that.
Did you feel there was much anti-Semitic attitudes in town at that time?
Well, I don't know. I think that the fact that a Jew was president of the school board, the only Jew on the school board was the president of the school board, there was a good bit of it. And anti-Semitism and anti-black feeling have always been linked somewhat in this country. And a lot of the personal mail that I got was anti-Semitic in nature, and there was some anti-Semitic leaflets handed out, just as there were yesterday in Baltimore.